This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hi, I'm Bao Tranchi. I am a costume and fashion designer. I costume design feature films, and I also have my own brand called Bao Tranchi, and it's a high-end women's wear brand.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thank you for coming on. About what does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
Oh, nowadays. Oh my God. This question is multi-layered, right? Just because what it means for me today comes from the result of a life lived, right? And just and I come from such an interesting perspective because, you know, like we have the first generation, we have the second generation, then we have the one and a half, right? And I've always found myself in a particular spot in it because I left Vietnam when I was 10 months old. So I, like the second generation of my family that was born in America, she's just 2 years younger than me. So like my niece is just 2 years younger than me. So we grew up together parallel, but in my family, I was still in their generation. But I never felt like, you know, because there was like a 22 year difference between me and my oldest brother. So, you know, being 2 years old, you know, so it kind of has shaped me into always in some odd ways feeling like on the outside and never fully fitting in. Right. And so I feel like I've spent so much of my life kind of finding that spot, you know, because I'm like not fully, I'm American. Like when I go to Vietnam, I'm very American. But then when I'm in America, I'm not fully American as well. And I'm, you know, so it's like straddling that. And so, but I think in that way, it's how I've always approached everything. It's just outside of the box, trying harder, just being a bit more like I've got to get people to see who I am and realize who I am, and I'm defining who I am. So, but what it means to be Vietnamese now, I mean, it's what an incredible time to be Vietnamese, right? I feel like we are the next wave.
Yes.
For sure. I mean, I've seen it building and building over the years. And, you know, as we say, OG, we've done a lot of work to build that. But, you know, I saw it when, you know, when we were first in the States, and it was the Japanese, And then, you know, it takes another decade and then it's the Koreans. And you see the Korean explosion happening now that's been building for the past 20 years. Yeah. And this is happening now with the Vietnamese community and culture and just everything visual that we're doing. So I think what an exciting time. Like, I don't even know what generation we're on now. Like, is it third generation?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where it's, and I feel like a lot of, and it's bringing such new, fresh air too, you know? And it's I had the wonderful experience of having my daughter in Vietnam, right? And ironically, she kind of had almost the same amount of time in Vietnam that I did, meaning I left Vietnam when I was 10 months old. She left Vietnam after she was 1 year old. 1 year old. And to this day, she's almost nine. She's obsessed with it. You know, like she wants to go back. I mean, I've taken her back when she was two and four. And it's kind of one of those things where it lingers in her. She wants to know more about it. And I think that's all she needs. And I love that. And I love that, you know, what is she going to do with that when she's older? You know, I can't wait to take her back. I can't wait to take her, you know, that I was planning to take her before COVID hit. But it's just the new ideas and where will she go with it? And Vietnam has changed. Like, it's such a beautiful time of representation, you know, like the amount of awareness to representation. We've never had this before. Awareness to diversity. I think we can do even better. I think it's going down the pecking order. And I feel like, you know, we are all doing our part for the Asian representation.
What kind of barriers did you experience when you were first starting out, or did you not? Some people don't. What did you struggle at all, you know, in terms of, or were you always so good at what you did that it didn't matter?
I mean, that's, I guess never even thought about that because I've never approached, I've never seen, I guess, awards, accolades, or disappointments from a racial standpoint. So it's never even been a part of my vernacular to ever blame it or to praise it. Does that make sense? Like, yep. I said, you know, when we first got into America, my father made a very conscientious decision to not move us to Little Saigon. And, you know, after I remember we were doing a press for Journey from the Fall, and one of the people had, my father was there, and they had asked him, well, why did you not want to join your Vietnamese community and go to Little Saigon? And his answer was very poignant, and it was because I wanted my children to create an identity outside of just being a part of a culture. Not that there's any, but he wanted us, you know, he'd escaped, he'd risked life, limb, everything to bring us over here. And he wanted us to create an identity, an individuality, you know. So I guess I was never brave enough, not brave enough to, I never even, but, you know, now, I mean, you know, there's definite, we're still fighting, you know, like I see it in certain industries where, you know, like, you know, in costume, there's not many Asian costume designers. Remember when we had Hillary Clinton running for president, and everybody's just like, I just can't imagine her as president. And that's because people have never seen a female president before. So it was just, well, that's not how presidents look, right? Well, so people go with what's familiar. It's kind of like, well, this is.
Now, when you were growing up and you were, you know, living with your parents, and you, what were you? What were you primed to do? What did you think that the future of your life would be?
Well, I pretty much, I mean, you have kids. And I feel like kids are pretty much born who they are. We do our best to kind of guide them and sure. All that, but their personality is so innate. It was very like one of those moments. I was sitting at the foot of my mom's sewing machine in a sweatshop. There's 100 sewing machines whirling around. And, you know, we didn't have, we're immigrants. We can't fucking afford daycare, babysitter, any of that. So I'm sitting with her. I'm like 2 years old. And I just knew. I just knew that this was going to not become a sweatshop sewer, but just the creation, the clothing. And then my father became a draftsman, like actually like drafted blueprints and everything, like on a drafting table at home. And I would draw with him. And it was just one of those things. So I always was different. I never had one of those. I'm going to go to school for accounting, or a pharmacist. I never even for one second knew I was not going to not do something artistic. I've known from the get-go that my threads are just woven from different colors than the rest of my family and those around me. And I've pretty much been spending my entire childhood like weaving all of that together to make sense, to become the individual that is me now, despite all of the obstacles, like family. We're immigrants. We're not taught to dream. We're not taught to, I mean, now is different. I'm talking, us.
Yeah.
It was a scary time. It was, we never even talk about the trauma our parents must have, right? Like, like my older brothers and sisters who were cognizant, they were, 17, 16, going through these, boat trips where we're facing pirates that are trying to rape my sisters. They're robbing us. They're vicious officers the camps.
Mm-hmm. On the camp. Mm-hmm.
And the refugee camps, and just so much trauma and the starving and all of that. And so, I just know when they arrived, it's just kind of like, put your head down and follow the rules like I think about the things I tell my daughter, and it's just like, dream big, be big, like it's your body, your rules, your imagination, your world, like everything, like just whatever you want to do.
I wonder about that a lot. I talk to a lot of the guests about that. Like, they have no constraints because we give them no constraints. We're like, just go and fuck shit up. Just go out and tear it up. Right. But then I feel like, because we were given so much constraints societally and culturally and, on that level, we were like these trees and seedlings that just wanted to pop out of the concrete and just grow and grow fierce. But I feel like, sometimes giving no constraint to our kids, I wonder what that experiment looks like in about, two decades from now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can definitely agree with you because, I can cite from personal relationships and stuff, I've seen that where the second generation because their parents were like, I don't want them to suffer like we did. So they gave them everything and gave them an easy path. And then they didn't have to fight, and it's that fire, right?
Yeah.
What do they say about diamonds? Pressure makes diamonds, right? And it's like they were given no, and it's kind of like, go to college, do what you want. And then they're kind of like,
they have no direction because they didn't have to fight for their vision.
Yes. And it's that fight that is the most incredible thing. I remember telling my niece when she was 17 and going to my school, Otis, and I was just like, you're gonna face kids who have more money than you, who are more passionate than you, who are more driven than you, who have, and that's what you're gonna have to fight against, And it was kind of sometimes that, and when it's all we knew from the moment we were here, was everybody has more than us. I mean, to this day, it's just like, it's that awareness, you know what I mean? So it's like, I feel like we've always had our boxing gloves on, right?
Yeah.
So we just have to be scrappier. And I do that when I, you know, like when I costume design, it's like, you have to think outside the box. And I find that too, you know, like with, certain, like I almost think so outside of the box. It's almost like there are no problems. There are just creative solutions. Right. And it's kind of like, and I remember when I'm just like, I have to be crafty. I'm smaller. I'm this. So what do I have to do? And, you know, I'm just like, okay, I'm going to go this route. I have to, you know, I think that there's something, I'm so thankful for it, because sometimes I'll work with other people and it's kind of like, oh no, it just can't be done.
I remember growing up, friends of mine, like my white friends that I really looked up to, and I would tell them that, and they would say, no, you don't get it. Like you're going to one day recognize, and these were older men that were 15 years older that I was hanging out with. And they're like, no, you're going to get it. One day you will appreciate the difference, the societal difference that you come from. And it won't be a weakness anymore. It'll be a some part of your armament. And you don't see it right now because you're still working out your mind, but one day it'll come in handy. And it's so true. I mean, whatever these guys told me, it's like, that scrappiness, that resourcefulness, it's all paying off now. Cause it's just, you know, we do things differently. We think outside the box.
Absolutely. And I think the word armament is like the perfect word for it, because it is. It's our self-made armor, right? And it's just layers and layers. I've always said, you know, like, live a life so that when you meet your heroes, that they want to hear about your stories.
Mm.
You know, and so you have to offer something more than just the average thought, the average way of living, the average way of doing things. You got to offer something unique and special for them to be like, hey, Bao, what do you think? And tell stories and, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. So it's how you do that. Everyone's path is unique, right? So it's,
Speaking of paths, there's a few tracks in fashion like designers can take, right? You could go and have your own label. You can work for a big corporation. You could do costume design. You could do so many things coming out of Otis, a design school, fashion design school. But how do you know sort of where your main track lies? Like, how do you figure that out coming out from basically art school?
Well, the interesting thing was, as soon as I graduated Otis, I was offered two jobs, two big roads that would take me in. And it was, Anne Klein had flown me out to New York, and they were like, I went over there. They were like, we want to hire you, this and that. And at the exact same time, Ariane Phillips, who's a really big Hollywood costume designer, she was just like, oh my God, I want to work with you on Queen of the Damned. So I was just like, oh my God, which one do I do? Do I go to New York and do the fashion? I just graduated, you know, with a bachelor's from fashion school. But I always known that cinema, movies, storytelling, you know, like I said, I love both so much, but like, you know, like I love the fastness and the speed of fashion, but I love the foreverness of cinema.
Wow.
You know what I mean? So beautifully
put.
So I picked the movie, but I always knew too that I would come back to it. You know what I mean? And it's kind of like, I've always done things parallel, and I've been able to build the careers on both sides simultaneously. I mean, you know, sometimes I wonder, you know, like, what if I had just focused on one? But I can't ever wonder that. It's just what I have. And it's just like, I've been able to accomplish on both ends. And that's just the path that happened and the opportunities that kept on coming.
Why do you think coming out of school, somebody gets offered two big deals like that? Like, what is it about the work that you did that you were offered that?
That I was unique. And I was different. Like at my so like the fashion job, I can give a really good example of that. So Anne Klein had actually asked our department chair for 15 students that she thought would be great for them. They didn't like any of the ones she picked. She picked all the ones that did what you were supposed to do, design what, you know, all the, and the, you know, and they were all like, you know, like I said, they are the forever behind the scenes employees. They're employees. They didn't care for any of them. So Anne Klein actually reached out to me on their own because they had remembered me from being at the school. And so they had my work and all this. And so they had called me outside of the school. School didn't even know that they flew me to New York. And then with Ariane, so I had done a design project for a mentor while I was at Otis for my senior project. And my sketches were at the designer store. And so the costume designer came in and she's like, oh my God, like these are like the best sketches. Like I want her. And so she reached out to me on her own as well. So it's, and you know, and it was just producing work that was innate to me. So it was true to me. And it was all these sketches I had done of like rock and roll designs. And so it was like a perfect fit with Queen of the Damned, you know, because it was all like just basically like rock and roll, like vampires, basically, right? And so it was just perfect timing and and exactly, you know, like I said, just be different, have a different voice. And I can't express that enough in terms of like the next generations and stuff, you know, it's make your voice known. Don't be scared of it. I mean, albeit I get it. We all have to make money and we all have to feed ourselves and stuff, but definitely in order to get your voice heard, do that original thought.
You know, there's so many designers that are struggling to mobilize and break into their, like the upper ranks, so many paths to do that. But how did you break through?
I would say one of the big breakthroughs I would say was with J-Lo. Like I would say in terms of really like having where it just kind of broke the ceiling. And I would even say even for her, you know, and J-Lo's, it was one of her individual most powerful viral moments where the whole, I mean, and I know it sounds crazy, but at like the whole universe was talking about nothing but that.
Okay. Can we take it a few steps back? Like how did it lead to that moment with the design that you put on her and how it even got to you meeting her and being in contact with her?
Yeah. Well, I mean, hold on. How far back do you want me to go? Like
as far back as the story would make sense. I want to hear the origin story as far back as you can go.
I guess it was how I came up with that dress and the collection and everything. If we really want to go back, was one of the biggest things that happened to me in my life that made me change up everything. You know, we all have chapters, right? And so this was when my mom passed away. And after my mom passed away, I was really, really, I was beyond devastated that I lost my mom at such an early age. I didn't expect to lose her at such an early age, but that I never, ever had a child and I never would see the ancestral genetic, you know, natural dream of seeing my mom hold my child. And that just destroyed me. And I was just like, oh my God, you know, like, and you know, and that whole life balance thing, like, oh my God, like you can't just pursue your career. You can't just do this. Like there are bigger things too. And so I knew that I wanted to have a child before my, my father passed. But he is still going strong. So all is good. Mm-hmm. And that was,
how old was your mom when she passed?
She was 69.
Well, that's very young. And how old were you, if you don't mind me asking, at the time?
Oh my gosh, I was 31.
Mm, yeah. That's right at that point where you know, you're probably know yourself really well. And then, but then it's like, what's the next stage, you know, with children and marriage and all that, right at that cusp.
Yeah. And I mean, and in hindsight, I never could have had kids at any point before that, you know, it was never the right person, never the right time, never, never. And I'm so happy I didn't, but it was just, you know, such a life awful travesty that I couldn't have had my children while my mom was alive. And then, so the point was, so I had my Sadie in Vietnam, and I remember it was the first time in my life where my body changed, and I fully, you know, on both spectrums, I fully saw how incredible a woman's body is in terms of just like, we're absolute fucking rock stars, superheroes, right? Mm-hmm. We create life with our own bodies. We create food with our own bodies. Like we're insane. We're amazing. Right. And then we're just supposed to bounce back and all of this, but it made me see designing from a more personal point of view of like inside and not just outside physical. And so then I remember I was in Vietnam and I'm postpartum, I'm nursing a newborn, and I'm just all like, okay. And you know, and I'm such an artist. I was getting jitters. They're like, oh my God, I need to get back in it. I need to get back in it. You know, I need my creative, everything was just going bonkers. Right. Mm-hmm. Because I need to create just as much as I do love my child. And so I'm watching everything that's, you know, what's going on in fashion and everything. And I'm just like, how do I do this? How do I compete with, you know, design houses that have way more money than me, have way more staff, I'm just one person. I'm just one person who just had a baby. How am I going to design and create, not just design, but have to create it? So it, I'm one of those designers who does everything. I can do my patterns. I draw it. I sketch it. I drape it. I make it. I make the sample. I'm my own fit model. And so I'm just like, and so this is what I'm feeling, you know. So I started creating this small 18 piece bodywork collection line, right? And this is where I'm going to get to, where sometimes you don't realize, and we'll talk again about the fire, the adversity, right? Like, so I'm, you know, I'm in Vietnam, I've been out of fashion, you know, and fashion's moving nonstop. It's kind of like one of those things where you can easily feel like, oh my God, like I'm left out of it, right? Because it's seasonal to seasonal and it moves so fast. I mean, I almost feel like no other industry where you have to create a number one hit so fast, so soon, every 6 months. And, you know, So I start creating it, and it's all about the body, and it's all about creatively carving it out, you know. And I was just like, I'm just going to use one fabric and see what I can do with it, right? And instead of, you know, lots of times, you know, designers will be like, oh, I'll use this $150 beaded fabric, and then, you know, all these other fabrics and all this. I was just like, no, I'm going to simplify it down to fucking integrity of the fucking design, and how well do I know the female body, right? And so I did it. I came back and I brought it to my I have a PR firm, that agency, and they repped me, and so they put it in their line and everything. And then so the first hit was, and I remember I remember my PR guy was just like, oh my God, I've never had a response like this. And so the first thing that hit was, it was predominantly featured in Taylor Swift's Bad Blood music video.
Wow.
Which was great. And a big deal. Like, I think it was on Selena. It was on Soraya. There was one more. It was on all these major, you know, lead girls in it, which was great. But then, you know, and then start getting all these other press hits and stuff, but none of that compared to what happened when J-Lo wore it. So I had gotten word that she had gotten my, her stylist had gotten my lookbook, and she loved it. And it was, and she was thinking that she wanted to wear that one of the dresses for her birthday that was coming up. And, I was just like, but you know, you never know. I mean, you have to understand, J-Lo is the biggest celebrity in the fucking universe. She gets Versace sending her free gowns, you know, like $2 million gowns. Just like, how do you compete? Right. And like I said, so, and I remember, it was kind of a lot like, well, you know, if she wears it, you have to agree that you won't let anyone else wear your designs. And I was just like, I can't agree to that. Right. Like it's like, I'm, you know, I have to support myself. Right. Like it's, and so I didn't know what she was going to do. So I was just like, so her birthday comes and it literally fucking blew the top off the universe. Like it went so fucking viral. It started with Kim Kardashian tweeting it.
But
it was
no agreements or anything at that point. She just wears it.
She just wears it. And the thing is with her, you don't know if she's going to wear it or not. Cause she could change her mind. She can, you know,
yeah. And at that point you said, no, I'm not agreeing to this.
I told my PR that I was just like, I can't agree to that. I want to, but I have to make a living. Right. Yeah. It's just like, I mean, cause, you can't feed yourself off of a press piece, right? It's, you know, you need sales, you need orders, you need things from the press piece. And so, and, you know, and I was just like, and I remember her birthday came and, you know, during the day she was doing all these outings. So the paparazzi is like, so I'm on my social media and, you know, she's doing birthday brunches and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, no. So you never know. And then suddenly at nighttime and it just literally exploded. And it was insane. Like I said, Kim Kardashian tweeted it immediately. It was just like, oh my God, like, can this woman be any more insane? And then it just went like wildflower and it's literally covered on every news outlet, everywhere. Everyone knows the dress. She kept the dress. It's in her, like, you know, wardrobe of her hits. And it's just one of those iconic moments that like you can never plan for, you know, like anytime where you're just like, oh my God, this is gonna break the internet, and it doesn't. Like you can't force it. It just happened. And so it was incredible. And so then immediately, like overnight, and like literally it was the first time where I'm like suddenly my phone is just going nonstop of just people following me. Just like it's my screen is just lit up the entire time. I was just like, and you know, in hindsight, I'm just like, I didn't even know what was happening. You don't know what's happening until it's happening. And you know, and nobody knew that just a couple months, less than a year before she wore it, I didn't leave Vietnam until November of 2014, and she wore it in July of 2015. So it was,
well, that's almost like overnight, right?
Yeah. Really, and it was just a brand new collection, and it was just like, this is what I'm gonna do. And I had taken the time off to have my child, which everyone always says is a career killer and this and that, right? Like and that's the thing, and that's the thing about living. Once you start really, you know, and when I say living, I mean like getting older, the process, the experience. You got to make time for the things that matter too. Yeah. Everything matters. It's the whole component of everything that makes up your life. You can't just be like, you know, if we were to follow what society makes us believe, none of us would have, you know, those deep things that actually matter when we're on our deathbeds. You know, yes, our career matters, and that is so important. It's critical to me. If I'm not, like, I value so much of my worth by what I create. But if I didn't have my girls, if I didn't stop, like, if I believe society, I mean, you know, and became a career widow and just sacrificed myself for that, like, I mean, it's not worth it. I mean, you know, you have kids. It makes it so much richer. The soup is so much richer. It's just, it's simmering, it's going, it's living, you know. And in the end, it's like, and especially when, you know, especially in this age of social media, and you can definitely feel so easily bummed out because you're like seeing everyone's highlight reel, right? While you're living the behind the scenes, right? And you're just like, oh my God, everyone's highlight reel is so fucking amazing. Everyone's in a ring light and everyone's all like luminescent, like everyone's like killing it. But it's you have to take a breath and realize just do the work and do what's important to you and live the life that is precious to you, and it will all add up, you know. And and I think also, I think people want to be around that light too, you know. And you don't want to become, I don't know, I guess with anything, it's that balance. I mean, it's so hard as an artist, you know, finding that eternal balance of creative to work to life to personal to love to friendship to family. Like, how do you balance all of that?
We struggle, and in the struggle, the beauty comes out. But without the struggle, you know, there's really no payoff to any of it. So I think doing the struggle every day and really just putting our nose to the grind is, you know, ultimately it pays off. I think it pays off big time. Now, once this JLo dress took off, how long did it take to basically change the trajectory of whatever you were doing in your life?
Oh my God. It was so, so tough. I will say it literally took me a full year to complete orders that I got from this, just because I was not equipped to do so. You know what I mean? I never, before this, I had done more, I would say, really like one-offs and custom and very extravagant things that would take me 3 weeks to make, you know, really, really special things. But that's also how I created a voice in the industry, was creating those unique things and getting that creative thing. And so this was the first time where I'm like, oh my God. And so this is a whole other facet of fashion that I had to learn, which was just like, how do I do it so I could actually sell more than, you know, I can't be sitting here sewing it one by one at a time, right? How do I get other people to make it? I've never done this before. So it was like a whole massive lesson. And
mass production.
But
it's still custom though, right?
It still is custom because, I mean, the dress is so complicated. I mean, most people wouldn't even want to take it on. And the amount that they wanted for it was just, I couldn't even make money off of it. You know, and you have to realize like that t-shirt you're wearing, you know, it costs them $1 to make mass production wise, right? Like, and they can sell it for, but like people were wanting like hundreds to make it. And I was just like, I can't afford that. And it's just because my technique that I had created in this bodywear line, nobody had ever done before. And the reason why it was so new was because I kind of came up with it because I didn't know, I was kind of in a box in Vietnam. And I was just kind of like, well, I'll just figure it out myself. And in that figuring it out myself, because a lot of times if you go to a manufacturer, they'll have like I always say you could feel it. Like you go to any department store, you go to Macy's or whatever, and the clothes just kind of have a commercial feel, commercial finishing, commercial everything. And it just doesn't feel special. And you can always tell when you have something that feels special, you know, and it's just because it's not manufactured in the cookie cutter kind of way, you know. So if I'd had proper money, I mean, I remember I sent one of my pieces off to a factory this was like a year after I sent one of my pieces to a factory in Colombia, and it came back and I was just like, and it just looks different. It's almost like the Target version of it. Which is, you know, it's, but I remember I was just like, it just looks different. It just feels different. And so,
can I stop you there? So, you know, this, piece comes back, but you say it feels different. Can you explain what that means? Because, I'm curious to hear, is it the seams that are not made to your spec, the fabric doesn't feel right? Because I want to know that, like the intangibles of why you're saying it didn't feel right.
I mean, if you really want me to go into like the fashion nitty gritty of it,
I want to go in the weeds. Yeah.
Okay. We'll go there. I didn't want to bore you with fashion talk, but no,
the more details, the more interesting for me. You know, I want to hear why would you think that it didn't feel right? You know, and because I try to apply this to other art forms in my life, and when I'm looking at other art pieces, I want to know what the artist thinks is, you know, that little subtle difference makes it's night and day. It's like Target or high couture, right?
Absolutely. One, fabrication, right? Like the type of fabrics I was using, there's always a cheaper version of it, right? Mm-hmm. And with mass production, you're trying to cut it as cheap as possible. The technique I was using, I would use like 50 yards of elastic for one garment. So when you are doing manufacturing, you want to cut costs, 50 yards of elastic adds up when you're doing like hundreds of thousands of units, right? So you're just like, no, well, why do we need to use elastic? We'll just fold it down and top stitch it, let's say, or we'll cover stitch it, right? We won't even use the elastic, or we'll use flimsily clear elastic or cheap elastic, which weighs way less. Like I have a very specific type of elastic that I like to use that is probably cost 10 times as much as the average one that they would use for manufacturing. And it's because it has a weight, it has a certain stretch. It's so specific. Mm-hmm. And it's normally more used for like lingerie and things like that. So it's more expensive because it has to look good, has to feel good against the skin. So things like that. So the quality of that is reduced. And then it just doesn't have the same weight, doesn't have the same pull. People love to use the overlock machine, like for fast fashion and things like that. Like if you look inside your t-shirt, that's all overlocked, right? I never use it in any of my knit stuff. Everything I do is either a French seam. So I come from a classically trained background. You know, mm-hmm. I went to Otis, which is one of the top schools for fashion. And I was trained in, I know how to tailor suits. You know, I know how to do ball gowns. I love old couture like techniques. So I took that I took all those techniques that I love to a medium that normally doesn't get that sort of love and attention, you know, which is like more kind of like bodysuits and sexy. And, you know, the simplistic thing of is just calling it lingerie, but it wasn't because I wanted it to be wearable, but just like endlessly edgy yet sexy. Yet and it's this fine line, you know, that I was trying to create where, it's just a timeless piece that you'll have that constantly makes you feel edgy, fucking cool, and you'll have it forever. So it's like an heirloom edgy fucking piece. Yeah. So I took all those techniques and I put them into my garments.
Okay, we'll go more into the weeds now. I grew up in the garment business because I.
Oh, you did?
I did. I was what you mentioned earlier about sitting next to my mom's sewing machine. I know how to overlock. I know exactly how to describe this overlock right now. We're going to get into it because overlock, and I want to know why you think or why it is that overlock is cheap. And overlock, to describe it to people who are just listening, there's multiple threads, right? There's multiple yes. thread lines. And so when you see overlocking, it's just like this fast way. It has a blade that cuts the excess fabric yes. off. Right?
And then it does the stitching.
Yeah. And it's sort of there's multiple threads that cover this edge, right?
Yes.
But why is that I hear what you're saying, but I want to know, why is that cheaper than, you said, the French hems?
The French seam, because it requires twice as much time. So you have to imagine, just in manufacturing, you could overlock it, you fucking run it through, it's right. done, right? So with French seaming, you have to sew it once, and then you got to flip it around, and then you got to like sew it again. So, and then a lot of times sometimes my French seams, I'll have them top stitch too, so it lays flat. So you're talking about 2 to 3 times the amount of time. So everything breaks down into numbers, right? So it's kind of like you could do it once or you could do it twice. So twice is going to take twice as long. And so then that just keeps on adding up. And for me, visually, like when you wash a garment that has the overlock threads, it'll start coming apart. It starts looking and you can see it. And if you have any fine garment, you will see that all the seams are hidden. It should look that way. And that was the school of thought that I was coming from, where I love looking into a garment and it's just as beautiful on the inside as it is on the outside. Like if I took this off right now, you wouldn't see any of the seams. Like you'd be like, where did you hide it? You know what I mean? Oh. And it's just like, so if I don't have, so a lot of times I'll also line things just so then I can sandwich the seams on the inside. A lot of people in straight manufacturing, they won't do that. because it's kind of like I said, it's adding another step. You know what I mean? You can just overlock that. They won't, instead of having two layers, they will just do one layer. Right. And so, cause I was doing all these things with like mesh over a piece of lining, because I liked how the mesh created a texture, created a new texture versus just using the lining. But many people who were knocking me off would just use the lining fabric. So it's all these things adds up, you know, what we're saying, it's just like every little stitch makes a difference.
So fascinating. I'm just so fascinated to hear it. Cause, you know, I can imagine the French hems are more comfortable to kind of when it sits in your body, right? Because yeah, the overlock threads are just like kind of like there's like, you know, it just feels uneven, right?
And then, you know, you have inconsistencies with manufacturing and people's machines. Sometimes it gets too tight. Sometimes it gets too loose. Sometimes it's, you know, there's what I call, if you can tell too, if you go to a store really cheap manufacturing, what they try to do to get it done super cheap and fast is they loosen the threads so that it's as wide as possible. So the finer it is, like it starts with, think about like a you know, if it's really fine, it takes up more thread. So like I said, everything to do with manufacturing comes down to numbers. And it's kind of like, so if you make it too close together, you're going to be wasting more money on thread. And so they'll just make it really wide. You can sometimes even see the fabric underneath, which isn't cute to me. And so it's just a visual thing of how do you keep on elevating it? Like I was saying, like, you can feel it. And I make things that are very sexy, and it makes all the difference. Cause all of my clients, I mean, like I have one of my favorite clients, and she was just like, you know, I took your dress to my dry cleaner, to my tailor to refit it for me after COVID. And he was just like, oh my God, it's so well made. Mm. You know, the only other person you said this about was like her Tom Ford dress, right? And it's just like for something sexy. And that makes all the difference, because when you're dressing super sexy and you're doing cutouts and you're doing things that are exposed, you want the person who's wearing it to feel expensive. And a person feels expensive when something just fits different, when something just goes on different, when it is finished different, and they know it's expensive, you know, and you just feel it. And it makes people act different, wear it different, and they don't, you know, I've had many fast fashion companies knock me off. And so I bought the pieces because I wanted to see their construction. I've decided to, I'm going to start making some videos of it and start posting them on as reels on my brand page. I want to dissect it for people. I actually do. I want to take it apart and be like, this is why you pay this. And why it's not the same. You know what I mean? Like this $59 version of it, there's a reason why.
No, this shit is so interesting. You know, it's so interesting. I listen and I'm so fascinated. You know, I read a GQ article when I was in my teen years. As a teenager, I read this GQ article. They were breaking down Banana Republic, Old Navy, and I think Hollister or some brand like that. It's a vertical company that owns these three.
All of them, yeah.
Right? I don't know if it was Theory, who owned it, but some big conglomerate owns, like, and then they broke it down. They're like, why would a company own these three when they basically kind of cover the same footprint, the same buyers, but the price points like are $5 or whatever. There's percentage difference in the cost of when you retail, when you buy it. And then they started breaking down like the sizes of the margins of error, you know, at the higher. And then when you go down and when you go down, the sizes are a little bit more loosey goosey. And at the higher level, like a Banana Republic, not to be like, that's not the highest, but.
No.
For this company that they own, it's like, okay, Banana is the highest and then Old Navy and then Hollister or whatever. So you don't get it's about the fit. It's about all of the things that you're talking about. And it always stuck with me when I read about that. I was like, oh, interesting. That's why, you know, a t-shirt today that costs $100 feels different when you wear it than a $20 shirt.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, you know, there are some people who do put out the same. I mean, you know, we could go into the glassware, you know, companies that own, that are making the same Ray-Bans as they are, you know, the $10,000 glasses and $5 glasses, you know, it's like,
That's a big scam. Like, yeah.
Or like the $500 t-shirt is being made at the same factory as the ones that are selling it for $50. You know, it's just like some people put the love into it and some people, but for the most part, yeah, there's a definite difference.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Now, I want to bring it back to our culture, to the Vietnamese culture, because there's some pertinence here for me. Like, when I think about, like, the quality of all of these details, like the Italians, when they made food or when they made fashion or films, their ability to go and drill down to the details were, and I grew up always like kind of like, nah, you know, Vietnamese culture, we don't have those things. But if we think about this, we were so busy surviving a war-torn situation, and we just didn't have at the time the luxury to really pay attention to the seam lines and to the fabrics, and we were just like busy surviving. And now today we have artists like you and so many other people in the film and music business that are now given this opportunity to really infuse high quality craftsmanship. And it's so, you know, it's so delightful to get to talk to you about these processes that are detail oriented, and we know why things are so elevated at your level now.
Yeah, no, and I love the details. The details makes all the difference.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've talked about this on the podcast so many times where I go into a home. I used to, again, my parents were into sewing, and so we did curtains and garments at, you know, one point or another, we were doing that. You go into a home and we would hang the curtains, and I started to pay attention to the paint lines. If they were like really well done paint lines and the walls are smooth and just crisp edge, you knew that the owners were very difficult and they were just very detail oriented. It's all about the paint lines.
Yeah, no, I love that.
Yeah, and if you go into homes where, you know, the paint lines are a little crooked, a little loosey-goosey, you know, they were going to give you an easier time. It'd be a lot easier to deal with. And, you know, I always paid attention to that because it was like, you know, if you go into a brand new home and they got blue tape, you know, up against the thing, that they're telling their painter, hey, we're moving in, you need to fix this before we move in. So as drapery installers like me for so many years of my life, going in to see blue tape was like a red flag. We're like, okay, guys, we have to like be very careful going into this job.
Yeah, 100%. Let me tell you a great story. I mean, it's just like where I love when I love when my fashion and my costume get to marry each other, intersect, and I get to use the expertise of both for something, you know. So like when I started prepping for Beer Run, it was, you know, we were doing Chicky Donahue's character. Can I start talking about it?
Yes, please. Yes, yes, yes.
So I knew from the get-go, you know, and just breaking down the script and stuff, that the one outfit, and it's true to the true story, Chicky Donahue, you know, wore the same exact outfit his entire time, right? And so he never changed. And so I knew that this outfit was going to be the most important, and you know, and we had to get it perfect. So you know, it takes place in 1967. And so the denim that he wore at that he wore these specific jeans, right? And you know, the fit from 1967 is different. And trying to find a vintage pair of jeans at any of the costume houses or any of the vintage stores, it's like a fucking needle in a haystack. And that it fits Zach's size perfect. But not just that, we need multiples. It's not like I could just find one. And it had to be a very specific color because Chickies was a very specific powder blue. So I was just like, we have to make it. Like we have to make it. But I knew that I wanted it to be exactly the fit had to be from the period. But the wash and the denim, obviously, of course, because we're making it, was going to be from now, but we had to do it so that it looked like 1967 and be authentic to it, right? And so I was lucky enough to find, I mean, I scoured everywhere. I was lucky enough to find one pair of vintage jeans from 1960s, that I was just like, okay, this looks like it will be like the good fit for Zach. So I fitted on Zach and
Did it come from the same brand?
no, it's a one-off one pair. I mean, I don't even think Chicky remembers what brand it was that he wore, and we're not supposed to use brands over there. But it was more like the silhouette, the cut, like how does it, you know, it has to look like it's authentic to Chicky's wardrobe. And so I found this, I fit it on Zach, and you know, I was just like, I took all the notes. I was just like, okay, it needs to have this and this in order for it to look more off that, you know, fit Zach better and everything. And so using my fashion connections, I called one of my good friends who works in denim, and I was just like, I'm working on this on this movie. Do you know anyone who knows denim? I need to make these jeans for Zach, right? And so she connected me with the actual Levi's textile denim provider for Levi's in based in Bangkok, right? So he's based in Bangkok. He has one of the biggest denim mills, and he actually, you know, currently right now is providing denim for Levi's in Asia. So I was just like, yes. So I wrote to him immediately, and I was just like, hey, you know, I'm Bao, I'm working on this movie. Will you work with me to make these
Wow.
custom denim? And not just that, I need to make like 30 additional pairs for Zach. I need to make it for his also his stunt double. And so he was, you know, as soon as, you know, I started talking with, so Amarin is the owner and CEO of Atlantic Mills. And he was just like, yes, I will work with you on this. And he was super excited about it. And but mind you, he's just all like, but hey, just to let you know, Thailand is going through a major surge right now. We're supposed to be prepping in Thailand. And I mean, this was when we were all like, oh my God, how are we going to do this? And he's just like, my factory needs to get closed down. Like pretty much. It was 20 every single day. It was like 25,000 cases today, 26,000 cases today, and you know, quarantines, curfews, everything was happening in Thailand. I was just like, how is this all going to happen? And he was just like, well, if we are out of quarantine, when you get here, I will meet with you, right? And so when I got there, I had to go into quarantine in for 2 weeks and stuff. And so I went through it, and he and in the process, he's just like, oh my God, I know this amazing guy, this Japanese guy who's based out of Thailand, who would love to go on this project with us. And he's like the denim guy, right? So he will actually make it for you and wash it at our wash house. So it's like we're like this little trio. And this is what I mean by like I'm always thinking outside the box. You know, anyone else could just be like, well, we'll just dub in these vintage pair of jeans, right? But I was just like, no, I need to get fucking Chickie Donahue's exact jeans. So if I can't find the vintage, I'll make the vintage. And that's where my fashion experience comes in, where I get to actually, you know, if we can't find it, we can make it. And you know,
Wow.
with technology and everything. And so between the three of us, we were able to come up with the first prototype, which is like, I mean, if you found it at a costume house and it was, you know, labeled 1967, you'd be like, yeah, of course it is. It was washed, it was aged, it was everything, it was perfection.
Why did you need 30 pairs?
Because he is going through, okay, so for you know, for movie making, you are, you know, you're not shooting in sequence. You're not shooting, you know, the beginning of the movie to the end. And so he's going through a journey. He's going through, he arrives in Vietnam and he goes through basically the war. And we're watching him go through it. So his clothes are aging. It's getting dirtier. It's getting messier. It's getting more war torn, basically.
He's wearing one pair throughout the whole time this guy's in Vietnam?
Yeah, in real life. He never changed. Because he didn't think he was going to be caught over there. He thought it was going to just be like, you know, a quick turnaround, like 48 hours and he'd be done. And so he ends up wearing the exact same thing. So we had to have aged versions of it, you know, I mean, like level one, level two, level three. And then like for each scene that you're shooting it in, you pull that whatever level it is at, you know, based upon the script and stuff. And then, you know, you want to have multiples, anything happens to it. And then we had stand-ins too. So we had stand-ins and then we also had his stunt doubles. So it's like everybody needs their own version and everything has to be aged the same. Everything has to look the same. And so this is like all the inner workings that people don't realize, but that's my attention and obsession with detail and getting it right.
So how did you get tapped for that project?
That is another incredible story.
All right. First of all, let's talk about The Greatest Beer Run is a movie starring Zac Efron. And was it shot in Vietnam? Say again?
Russell Crowe.
And Bill Murray. Three big stars in Hollywood. Was it shot in Vietnam? I know the backdrop is Vietnam, but was it shot in Vietnam?
No. Vietnam would never allow for this movie to be shot over there. I mean, it would have been amazing. And not only that, Vietnam was shut down. This was prime. I mean, I remember I thought I could prep. I remember when I agreed to take on the movie, I was just like, okay, great. Like for Vietnam scenes, for, you know, I can get stuff made over there or pull from there or buy from there and super authentic. And then, you know, I had my assistant over there already tapped and like ready. And then I would talk to him. He's just like, I don't know. He's just like, we're now, this was at the point where they were shutting people, locking people inside their homes. Shit. Do you remember this?
Yes, I do.
Where, I mean, Vietnam is like fierce, where they literally locked people inside.
They don't give a fuck.
Yeah, no fucks given for sure. People talk about freedoms here. I'm just like, you did not grow up in a communist country, bitches. It's like a whole nother level of freedom, right?
The top for the project.
Oh, this one, this is an incredible, and this is what I mean. It's kind of just like being the exact right person with the exact right skills, you know, I'll go back. So I had, and I think it was just like, so I get a phone call. It was the day where I dropped my daughter. And I remember it was very clear. I dropped my daughter off to her first day, my second daughter story. I took her to her daycare. And I remember while I'm driving there on the way back, I get this message, right? And it was from Q Kin. And I had just seen her at my daughter's first birthday just a month ago, right? And I remember it was like the first big, like, not like kind of like we were kind of getting out of COVID. So I was potentially creating a COVID spreader. Nobody got COVID from my event, but it was my daughter's first birthday. She was born during COVID. I was just like, you know what? And I remember, and then like I said, like just do it if you can. I was just like, I wanted to make it a big deal for her. She's been in hiding her entire life. Like, let's make it. There was over like 125 people at her first birthday. It was like, I had like 15 tables set up in my like backyard. Like it was massive. It was beautiful. It was amazing. Right. And so Kyu Kin, of course I love, like Kyu Kin and I go way back. I think we've done two movies together.
Journey and
Finding Julia.
Oh, okay.
Which is another fascinating one, but anyways, so we had done that together. And then, so we're very close. It's kind of like, I love her so much. Yeah. I mean, beyond beautiful and just inside outside, like I love Kyu Kin. So she called me and she was just like, hey, I guess one of her friends was, consulting on, she was tapped to be a consultant on Beer Run. And so they wanted to find a Vietnamese costume designer. Right. And, I didn't know at the time, but they had already hired a costume designer. And this person is, you know, Hollywood veteran. She's done over, you know, she's been in the industry for over 30 something years. She's, you know, I can name her the movies she's done, like just veteran, right? Anyways, she had signed on and she had done, and she quit the movie. And it was because it got too hard. It was like, it was too complicated. It was, you know, and this is what I mean about that fire and that scrappiness. I'm just like, yeah, do a movie in Thailand during a COVID lockdown. Fuck yeah. Let's do it. Right. Like the more challenges, the better. And, you know, and for her, she's just like, I don't need to do this. I don't need to make it so hard. Like, how do I, because the production was like, you're going to have to make everything in Thailand, you know, but how do you make everything in Thailand? We had over 4,500 extras total for the movie, right? And we're making everything. And you have to think, like, for military, and everybody has different size shoes, right? We have to make shoes. So it's not like you could just go to, there's no costume houses in Thailand, like how we have, and even out here, you know, like, it's not like here where you're like, oh, I want, like, you know, 1,000 military uniforms, you know. It's just like, we had to make everything. And so, and how do you make it? You have to have a pattern. You have to start from scratch. You have to source the fabric. You wow. have to have fittings. You have to make sure it's, I can tell you a gazillion stories about making every aspect of every part of it, you know, and even just like the military uniforms. We're not even talking about our leads. We had over like 75 principals, you know, like all throughout the movie. It's a lot. It's not like it was just, you know, Zach and Russell and, you know, like it's, you know, it wasn't like a small cast. It was a massive cast with massive amounts of background, and everything had to be custom. So it's just like, who wants to take that on, right? Yeah, and
you're a veteran. You're comfortable. You find
yes, something. Yeah. You get comfortable, and so she didn't want, and which opened up the door for them to think outside of the box.
Wow.
And you know, and this is where it's a beautiful thing about Pete, where he actually really valued the authenticity of it, you know. And I feel like that's the thing, as much as Hollywood likes to talk about like diversity and representation and this and that, at the end of the day, who are they hiring for key head positions?
You throw out names so casually. Let's talk about Pete. Pete, we're referring to as Pete Farrelly here. You're like, oh, Pete. You know, no. Let's let the audience know. This is Pete Farrelly, who directed Dumb and Dumber, Shallow Hal, Something About Mary. I mean, the hits go on.
I mean, let's start The Green Book, which he won the Oscar for Best Picture.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and this is his follow-up to his Oscar win. So it was, you know,
big problem. No big deal.
Yeah, like, but Peter. What is it?
You're like, no, you just threw it out casually. I'm like, no, let's stop put the brakes here. We got to like, let me break it down and let people know how important this project was. It's a big project. Peter Farrelly.
Yeah. Oh my God. Like, yeah, it's massive. It's major, you know what I mean? And like I said, in the beginning, like when you meet your heroes, like live a life so that they want to hear what you have to say, right? Like I could have just come off as a total hack, right? And you know, he's not just going to hire me just because I'm Vietnamese. It's just like, I got to have the chops and actually be able to back it up. And the beautiful thing was, I remember after I talked, so the point was, so Kyu-Kien had told the consultant, so she quit. And so at this point, she's already, I think already a month has already passed by in terms of prep, like the production designers already in Thailand prepping. And so already a month of prep is lost. And it's like the schedule is set. So it's not like they're like, oh, well, we could rewind time because you lost a month of prep. It's like, no, like, so in addition to COVID, making everything during this time, it's like you get a month less of prep. So it's just like, and so anyway, so they're like, I gave your name. Kyukin was just like, I gave your name and there's a producer. His name's Andrew Moscato. He's going to call you. And so this is Andrew's baby. So Andrew was the one. And, you know, if you researched like Greatest Beer Run Ever, he had done the original documentary in 2015 about Chickie Donahue, which pretty much exploded into where we are today with Zach and Russell and Pete and everybody. And the movie's having its premiere at Toronto Film Festival in 2 weeks, right? So he was the one who gave birth to it. He was the one who recognized in Chickie an incredible story and made, I think it's like a 15-minute documentary about it. And it just kept on growing from there. And so Andrew was the one who called me and was just like, hey, you know, introduced himself. And so I got on the phone with Andrew and it was like, and it's just one of those things where it was immediately familiar. I was just like, oh my God, like we were, it was no nerves, no anything. I was just like, you know, like when you know that you are the right person and that, and I told Pete this when I was talking to him, I was just like, not to be super cheesy, but I used the line from Taken that Liam Neeson used, which was, I'm totally going to paraphrase it wrong, but it was kind of like, I've honed a very particular set of skills my entire life that makes me basically the perfect person for this job for you. So it's just like, you can find people with more credits on IMDb, you know, I'm sure you could find a veteran who's done 50 more films, but they won't have had the experience and the personal connection and the just the chops and the cultural know-how. And just, this is my blood. You know what I mean? Like, this is my ring. Like, this is my arena. I know it. Working in Thailand, working in Asia, like all of this, just the story. I was just like, this is me. Like, it couldn't be a better fit. And so when then Andrew was just like, I'm going to get you on the phone with, first he got me on the phone with the line producer, and then he got me on the phone with Pete, Zoom. Both of them were Zoom calls. And I remember, you know, and it's one of those things where you're just like, oh my God, I'm about to meet with Pete Fairley. Like how, you know, and it was the most incredible, like warming, I'm so relaxed. It felt like I've known his spirit, you know, his energy for way longer than this. And it was just so easy. It was so fantastically easy to talk to him. And it was so natural. You know, there was nothing that had to be, I didn't, you know, I'm not even pondering about what to say. Everything is just naturally, like, it's just me being intrinsically who I am, intrinsically telling my story, intrinsically telling him my vision and what I wanted to do. And, you know, I was telling him about other Vietnam movies and what I thought of them. And it was just like, we were two, you know, friends who were just chatting about the movie, instead of, you know, like, it wasn't an interview. It didn't feel like that. And then after the end of it, he was just like, my God, you're perfect. Congratulations.
Can you go through some basic stages of that process?
What do you mean? Like emotionally?
I mean, like you get a call from the producer and then what happens next? Like you go into pre-pro, like, you know, then you start sketching, or how does this work? Can you kind of, again, oh my God. I'm not looking for a masterclass, but you know, I'm curious about, I'm sure a lot of people are wondering, like when you get a call like that from somebody, what happens next? And then what happens? And then do you assemble an Avenger team under you to kind of like piece all this together? How does this work from like start to finish, if you can?
Oh my God. I mean, this is a major, this is a masterclass.
Kenneth. You could just give me just sort of like chapter titles. That's all I want to hear.
Okay. Like from start to finish, like what do you do? How do you design a major feature like this?
Okay. So you get a call and you're like, okay, cool. You talk with the line producer, which is, he's asking you for a budget, right? They're trying to figure that out.
And mind you, the line producer like produced all of the Mission Impossible movies. So like no big deal.
I want to expose the audience to sort of like the inner workings of like how that works. And again, not a masterclass or not anything detailed, but like, you know, week by week, what happens, you know, you get this and you have to submit like a detailed budget, line items for them to know. And then you have to tell them about what team and what your vision, like, how does this work? And then how many weeks of shooting did you do? And
basically, it happened real fast, right? Because like we were already behind. So basically, as soon as you know, after I talked to Pete, and it was just like it was a go. Then of course I had to do, you know, you have to get your deal approved, and you have to get all that before you can even go on. And then as soon as that was done, it was literally like, hey, Zach is going to be in LA for literally a 6-hour layover. Can you do a fitting with him in 3 days? It was literally like that. And it was just like, yeah, of course. Right. Because it was literally, it was his next project. It was his project that he was going to do before Beer Run. So he had a layover in LAX and he wanted to do his fitting. And this was the only time that I was going to see him before he was going to be on set, just like a week before we were shooting. So because he's our most important, I needed to get him, you know, so
yeah,
done and approved right away. But it's literally like 3 days. So literally me and my assistant, Roman, we went and pulled all these clothes. And that's when I was able to find the magic pair of jeans that I was able to base his ultimate final finale jeans, denims on, and all these shirts, all these everything, and just creating the lookbook for Pete to approve, you know? And so we put it all together and we met up with Zach, and it was, you never know when you're meeting with like major stars and this and that, right? Like you never know. And he might be tired. He's traveling. It's a layover. Oh my God. It ended up being like an
LAX.
What is it?
Go to LAX to meet with him.
Yeah. Well, they have these luxury suites, these private suites, and it's for celebrities and stuff to rest in between their layovers and stuff. And so we agreed to meet there, and it was like the same thing like with Andrew and with Pete. Wow. Where it was just, we hit it off immediately, and it ended up being like 2-hour fitting. And not because, but it was just like Zach was so giving and so great. Like I was saying, he was so excited too, and he was just like, I'm usually told what to wear. And you know, when he walked in, I had the music playing because, you know, from the script and stuff, you know, Brian, Pete, and Brian Curry, Pete Jones are the screenwriters for the script alongside Pete Farrelly. So, so they had inserted in all the music that they wanted. And so I was playing it.
The details that you put into the fitting.
Yes.
It's like you're playing the music of the movie.
Yes.
While you're fitting him.
So he walked in and I was just like, I wanted him to vibe into Chicky and be Chicky, you know? And so it created a mood and it broke the ice right away. Instead of it, you know, being, you know, as they say, you could hear a pin drop. Nobody wants that in a fitting, right? Like you want it to, like what we're doing is creative. Like he's embodying another character. So it was literally, we were so excited, but even down to the underwear and the socks, like we had, you know, and this is a great thing with, you know, having it based on a character that is still alive. Like Chicky Donahue is still alive, kicking and amazing. Mm. Like he is, I mean, he is a storyteller for days. I finally got to meet him in New Jersey. And also, email Andrew Moscato, who was the liaison with Chicky, and I'll just be like, so what kind of socks did he wear? What kind of underwear did he wear? And me and Zach would have these conversations about like how important it was that, you know, even down to that, like inhabiting the character, because it makes you walk differently, you know, and nobody ever thinks about it. But if you were to suddenly be given someone else's underwear style, especially from 1967, you would definitely stand up or sit down way different, right? Because you have to take yourself out of the character you're playing, you know, and it comes down to all those little nitty characters. And Zach was amazing for that. He was so excited, was super into it. And I can't wait for everyone to see this movie, just to see how he completely abandons your previous notions of how you see Zac Efron. Does that make sense?
Yeah, he's grown.
Yeah, he's grown, but also he also still has that Zac Efron aspect that makes you love him and makes him so lovable and why people are champion him, you know? So it's not like, it's just like all suddenly like serious, you know, it's a Christian Bale, you know, right. It's like.
So Zac Efron's essence, his boy.
Yes. Yeah. The Zephyrance is still there. So, as we said, exactly.
So you go through fitting him and
then of course, like I said, you have to do the breakdown of the script. So not just Zach's character, but there, like I said, we have like 75
and you have to worry about everybody's details.
Everybody's look. Everybody.
How much time did you have from the minute you got the call till principal photography camera start rolling?
I'm actually looking at my phone to actually remember. I mean, and here's the thing. Here's the other added thing. So by the time I had the fitting with, after my deal was closed and after I had the fitting with Zach, like literally the production designer, everyone's already in Thailand for like a month already, right? And the problem is I have to get paperwork and visas to get into Thailand during COVID, which is a whole other situation. Yeah. So that took another, I think, almost 3 weeks before I could even go over to Thailand. And not to mention, as soon as I land Thailand, I'm in quarantine for 2 weeks. When I say quarantine, that means I am in a hotel room locked up and I can't leave. So I'm prepping as much as I can during those 3 weeks of waiting for my visa in LA, pulling what I can and coordinating with, I have a Thai costume supervisor. So I'm like working two shifts where as soon as it's 6 o'clock my time in the US, I'm just like, okay, now it's Thai time, right? Like now I got to work with her. And I start coordinating with her, like pretty much like, this is everything we need. Where can we get this made? And because of the quarantine, you know, certain factories, you know, you can only operate if there's like, let's say 10 employees or less. And so we're splitting up everything. So I'm coordinating with her. Like I'm pretty much every single day, like setting her, we need to make this, make this. And it's just like nonstop. I finally flew into Thailand on, I think, August 6th, right? At this point, it's like August 6th. And the first day of shooting is September 13th.
Oh my God.
And I still have 2 weeks of quarantine that I have to do. So, and then at this point too, I've realized that everything that I thought I could have my assistant pull, make, or buy in Vietnam, done, dead, out the window. I can't do it anymore because Vietnam is shut. Oh, it was absolute lockdown. You couldn't ship anything in, you couldn't ship anything out. And so I was just like, okay, now we're going to have to shift. And thank goodness I know how to manufacture, right? Because I'm just like, now we're going to have to shift gears and we're going to have to make everything, source everything, do everything out here in Thailand. And so while I was in quarantine, I found out through the hotel that my costume team can still send things in. They just, you have to send it to the front desk and then they spray it down and all that. So I've already, you know, as soon as I landed in Thailand, I had brought all these, part of my prep was I had bought all of these vintage military uniforms, anything, Ao Yai's from like the 1960s. I bought, I sourced it everywhere. And so then I sent them out to my supervisor, to my costume department, and then I had them knock it off so that the fit was actually authentic to the actual vintage pieces. You know what I mean? So they were actually taking the actual specs. And even then, I remember they would send me the samples that the manufacturer would do. And I was just like, no. And I could show, I wish I could show pictures. I'm just like, no, this is wrong. And I would literally layer them next to it and explain to them why, you know, what makes it 1967 versus, you know, I'm just like, this is definitely like way more like 1990. Like, this is like, they're making it more like Desert Storm, like fit. I'm just like, this isn't right. The you know, the wash, everything. I'm improving all this inside of a hotel room. And, you know, I'm getting Ao Yai's made based on old specs. I actually even brought for them one of my mom's original Aobaba that she had worn on our boat trip. So this was her refugee, like the one that she wore, it was one of my family heirlooms. And so I'd sent it out to my team so that they can do a pattern of it, knock it off, so we could have authentic, because, you know, Albaba's Aoyai's now don't fit the same as they did in the 1960s, you know, nor the from the 50s. Every era, you know, it's fashion, it changes and stuff. So authenticity. So I'm doing fittings inside my room. And so as soon as I get out, we were shooting in 3 weeks.
And how long was the whole shoot?
The shoot. Okay. So hold on. I'm actually looking at a calendar. I'm just like, oh my God. Like, well, this was just part one. We still had a whole, it was like, we were doing two movies. One takes place in Vietnam, which we were shooting in Thailand, all throughout different parts of Thailand. And then the other one was being shot in New Jersey to dub in for Inwood, New York. So, and they're both, each their own feel, each their own cast, just as big in either one. You know what I mean? I mean, when you watch the movie, you'll see we just had just as much. And it's like, it's two different worlds. So first we meet Chicky and we see his life in New York, his family, his friends, everything. We're seeing 1967 Inwood, New York, right? And so, you know, while we're shooting, we're starting shooting in, I'm just looking at my calendar. While we start shooting, I start having to design and prep for New Jersey. So it's intense. And we have hundreds and hundreds of, you know, background in New Jersey as well, too, as well as all these like major principal like cast as well, besides Chicky, you know, Zach and all of that. And so I had an ACD in LA, and that's assistant costume designer, while I was shooting in Thailand, I was sending her all of the looks, like this, you know, this is Christina, this is Noodle, this is Red, this is these are the characters, go for these looks. And then she would pull them from the costume houses and then like send them to me, and I would approve them. And you know what I mean? It was just nonstop. I mean, all these little intricacies too, that, you know, we have protest scenes where there are nuns, but they are very specific nuns, you know, from the 1960s, from a certain order. And then, you know, we had policemen, we had like, it was just so many details to it too. You know, we had protesters, we had churchgoers, we had funeral goers, we had bar people, you know, we had bar scenes. And it's just all these different layers of characters and wardrobe that we needed while we're shooting in Thailand. And we're shooting on location in Thailand. And it's just like, we're talking about like showing up on set and everything has been rained out, where, wow, you know, it is, we're knee high in mud, you know, and we're wading through water, like literally just to go to the bathroom. Like, you're wearing boots and it's people are rowing. It's crazy. So it's all these, I mean, the making of it is just as, it's pretty incredible.
And when was the last day that they finished, when they wrapped?
The last day, hold on. Let me, so we all flew into, okay. So we shot from September 13th until, October, I think 25th in Thailand. Right. Mm-hmm. But then I think the first day of shoot for New Jersey was November 1st.
Wow. So this is a good few months.
Yeah. And then we shot in New Jersey for, I think, like 3.5 weeks after.
So mentally, during this whole time, getting, you know, bombarded with a gazillion details, how is your mental health? Because, I mean, probably missing your daughters and, you know, life is just in a constant perpetual state of imbalance. How do you deal with that?
My whole life has been like this, right? So it's not like I've been having this like cush life where it's always
like this, that.
Yeah. And every single time I do a project, I'm obsessed. I become obsessed with it. And my family knows this. And it's kind of like, that's all I see. I inhabit it. I breathe it. I live it. I'm obsessed with it.
You thrive in that environment then.
Yeah, I love it. I love, and this is why for me, I love location shoots because you don't get the distractions of your regular life. You know, and when I say regular life, of course, if my daughter isn't feeling well, of course, I'm going to be concerned. But like, that's, it's a great, you know, and this is why technology is amazing. I got to still, I knew the big picture of what we were creating, and I knew the big picture for my girls. And, you know, like I said, like, and I think, you know, like our parents throwing us on a boat, if our parents can throw our you know, us on a boat in the middle of the night, we can do a fucking movie. Right? I mean, and what a fucking honor and joy to do a movie versus like, so, you know, we got small problems.
All right. So this is all behind the camera, but are there opportunities or have you been in front of the camera?
What do you mean? Yes. Wait. Yeah, I actually just wrapped.
Can we talk about this or not?
Yeah, we can talk about it. I just won't name it.
Okay, cool. Teasing it so out. Yeah.
So this is another fun thing that is going to be coming out. Probably very like the beginning of 2023. They're editing it right now. We just wrapped on it. And so I am actually going to be starring in a new series for a big network that streams in every country except for Russia and China and maybe North Korea. I don't know. But who knows what North Korea is up to these days. But yeah, so it's massive and it's major, and I'm in.
How exciting. Is this your first time in front of the camera?
No, it's not.
You're gonna leave it at
that. I mean, but for this extent where I'm you know, in terms of like the show and how much I'm in it.
Yeah.
Like I said, I can't reveal too much about it. So I will be kind of evasive about, but I'm in it. I'm in it a lot. And so this is the most in terms of like a continuous, you know, I've done a lot of guest judging, you know, like America's Next Top Model, Project Runway, things like that, you know. And so I'm very comfortable in front of the camera in terms of playing myself. I think that's my best quality, is I know how to be myself.
Yeah. Now, can we expect other things besides the show that you just talked about? Are there other projects that we should be looking out for in the near future?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all happening right now. That is that I'm lining up. So, but I can't divulge too much until things are finalized, so to speak. But yeah, for sure. No, I'm always cooking up, and it's such an extraordinary time in my life of just, you go through major chapters in your life, and I feel like I'm in the next big chapter of my life.
I can feel that energy from you.
Oh, can you? Yeah. No,
it's like everything's just aligning.
Yeah. And I'm obviously, of course, you know, a major life things happened and shifted. And I'm in a totally different place than I was a year ago. But it's all happening, you know, and, but it's all good. And it's all, and I feel like a different person. And that's the thing. There's no end point to what we do. There's, you know, there's no like, yes, I've done all I needed to do. No, it goes on.
Yeah, there's no arrival.
Right?
Yeah.
And it keeps on growing. And it's like, and I always say too, it's about sustaining it. It's not, and in sustaining it too, you have to be organic with the process too. You can't just be so stoic and so stiff with how you do it and what route you do it. You know what I mean? It's just like the easiest way for life to like show you a wrench is to think you know how it's going to happen, you know? And it's like, it doesn't. And you, so I'm at the new chapter and I'm like actually really, really excited. So a lot of stuff is happening, and the more, I'm blossoming, the more it's happening.
This idea of representation, because we talked about that before and we kind of went back and forth, you know, it, this is a new time for that. You know, we are given this opportunity. You know, can you give me your thoughts on like your participation in that sort of world of representation? Because we had mentioned that, you know, with being in front of the camera, behind the camera. Do you have any final thoughts on like, you know, what the rest of Asian Americans, you know, what kind of words of encouragement can you give us that going forward in the future?
Oh, wow. Representation is so important. And we have to see, as we're creating, we have to be, I think, be mindful of the legacy that we want people to not just remember us by, but our, how do I say, our people. But I remember during the last, you know, during the 4 years of, you know, the last administration that I don't like to talk about, I went around wearing a shirt that said, "This is what an immigrant looks like," you know, and it was important for me. It was important for me to showcase my accomplishments and make it parallel to the fact that, you know, I've been able to accomplish this as an immigrant and why, and just, you know, and just dispel like awful, you know, stereotypes and also breaking ceilings of positions that people should have based on race or things like that. You know, when I was on the show, the one for that's coming out, it was a big platform for me. It was just like, this is who I am. I'm representing not just being a woman, a mother, but I'm also a refugee and an immigrant. You know, it's just like, and you know, and I, you know, I am who I am, and I've accomplished what I have. I dress how I do, and I'm all these things, you know what I mean? And it's just like, you can't peg me, but it's just like, I when you see me, you see that I'm all of these things. And I want us, you know, culturally to do that, for people to recognize us, not just because there's for diversity or because we're Asian, but because of what we're doing. And then that is the extra bonus. Does that make sense? So it's kind of like,
so much sense. Yeah.
Like, so just fucking be extraordinary. Yeah. Just fucking do amazing work. Just fucking like do the work and be there. There is, you know, sometimes like you were saying, like I fear, you know, generations now who've been given it too easy, or just watch, you know, shows, The House of Ho or something. They're like, and you know, social media, and they're just like the overnight success, the overnight, well, if I have followers or if I'm, you know, or whatever, then that makes me successful. But it's just like, I guess what I want to say is, I'm like, good God, you are handed already third base.
Yeah.
Imagine what we've had to struggle with. You guys could accomplish and climb even bigger mountains. So when we say, you know, like, do whatever you want, no, like have those really big goals and think of it as the impact of what we're doing for our Vietnamese people, our yeah, you know, our parents, just everything. So their power and their reach is even more potentially powerful now. So like, I want them to know the power that they can fucking harness and use it for fucking magnificence, you know, not squander it. You know what I mean?
I do. You know, I describe Bao Nguyen this way. He dreams big, but he executes bigger than those dreams. That's his sort of ethos, you know.
Yeah.
I see it constantly with him. It's, he has these big ways of dreaming, and then when he goes to execute, he even goes above and beyond. It reminds me a lot about you, the way you view the world, but there's this sort of organic way, you know, that you're going about the world, and it's beautiful to witness. Thank you so much.
Oh my God, thank you so much, Kenneth, and thank you so much for doing this and just spreading, you know, the awareness and the word, and just giving us that platform for our voices. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcast. Thanks again for listening.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.